It's Thursday, January 6, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. All eyes were on Washington, D.C. on Wednesday as the 112th Congress was convened. It is a part of the pageant of democracy, and it was amazing to see the sights as in the well of the House of Representatives, not only did you see all 435 members of the House, but you also saw members of their family, their wives and children, spouses, gathered there as in this very proud moment they repeated the oath of office. Of course, a good deal took place on Wednesday. The House elected its Speaker, John Boehner. And, of course, he replaced Nancy Pelosi, this because of a 64-seat pickup by the Republicans in terms of the House of Representatives. In the Senate, Vice President Joe Biden administered the oath to lawmakers that he had both campaigned for and against last fall, as the Associated Press pointed out. It's going to be interesting to see what comes out of the new Congress, but it has a very heavy agenda. It is always the case that there's great political anticipation when a new Congress is seated. After all, it's only happened 112 times in the history of this nation. But in a rather unprecedented way, this particular Congress is receiving, well, you could say it has had several balls kicked to it all at once. And that was a metaphor that was picked up by the new Speaker of the House when Speaker Boehner said, "No longer can we kick the can down the road." There are certain issues that are going to arrive on the agenda of this Congress, and very quickly. It's going to be interesting to see how President Obama and the new leadership in the House of Representatives and, of course, the new makeup of the leadership in terms of the composition of the Senate will also work out. It'll be interesting to see if some of the bipartisanship that marked the last of the 111th Congress, in particular the lame duck Congress, will be repeated. A very interesting article appeared in Newsweek magazine having nothing to do with exactly what took place on Wednesday, but with changes that have taken place not only in the composition of Congress, but in the way members of Congress live. Lisa Miller wrote an article entitled "The Commuter Congress: Families Don't Move to Washington Anymore and Lawmakers Live on the Road." And that is a very interesting aspect of all of this. It turns out that if you rewind political history, just going back about three decades, almost all of the families of members of the House of Representatives, almost all of the families of United States senators lived in Washington, D.C. Election to office meant a move to Washington, D.C. And there was an entire culture of congressional families that lived in the neighborhoods of Washington and surrounding counties. And what has happened now is that with changes that came about largely under the leadership of former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, members of the House of Representatives now spend a relatively few amount of days of each week in Washington. And those are the weeks they are in Washington. According to the schedule that was put out by Majority Leader Eric Cantor in December, members will spend this in Congress, the 112th Congress, 11% fewer weeks in legislative session than they did during the 111th Congress. Now, what's going on here? Well, fundraising is a big part of this, but also the cost of moving a family to Washington. The fact is that even though we pay members of the House of Representatives and the Senate what would be considered nationwide a good salary, it is not enough to sustain two homes, one in the district or one in the home state for the Senate and one in Washington. Furthermore, families find the dislocation of moving to Washington and the context of the Washington culture much less receptive than was true throughout most of the history of the nation's capital. Lisa Miller's article is interesting. She points out the loss that takes place when you have members of the United States House of Representatives and the Senate spending so much of their time on the road. As a matter of fact, several of the observers quoted in the story said, "You want to know where representatives and senators live? It's on the road and in the air. They land and occasionally are in Washington and occasionally in their home district. And as one spouse said of her elected husband, we'll just see you when you get home." Now, looking at this, I have to say there's something relatively sad about this, and I don't mean that in terms of political nostalgia. There's something sad here about requiring our elected representatives to be on a rat race of fundraising and other events that means many of them will sustain massive damage to their marriages and to their family lives because of the demands of public service. In an elected system of government as we have, in a representative democracy, it is very important that the people who are elected to office represent us because they are like us. And if indeed we make it so that only the very wealthy can be elected, that's one danger right now in our political system, or persons willing to sacrifice their families are elected, well, there's something very dangerous there for the future of democracy. Speaking of danger, the nation of Pakistan is a place of great danger right now. And one of the great disasters that has befallen that nation is the assassination of Punjab Governor Salman Taseer at age 66. Now, we've been talking in recent days on this broadcast about the danger that has come in terms of anti-Christian violence and the danger of anti-blasphemy laws, about which I've spoken and written in recent days. That's exactly what's going on in this assassination. In this case, the governor of the Punjab state was assassinated because he had spoken on behalf of a Christian woman who has been sentenced to death for supposedly slandering Islam, which can mean anything, including just giving a word of Christian testimony. In this case, one of the most ominous developments is that he was assassinated by one of his own security guards, a member of the police. As been pointed out by several members of the international press, this points out just how deeply the police and intelligence services in Pakistan are infiltrated by Islamic extremists. The New York Times editorial page is spot on when it concludes its editorial on this assassination with these words: "Ultimately, only Pakistanis can save their nation, and they must answer the more profound questions. Do they want a country in which Muslims and non-Muslims can peacefully coexist, or one in which religious zealots espousing the most intolerant interpretations of Islam kill anyone brave enough to defend the defenseless? That would be the true blasphemy." I don't find myself always in agreement with the editorial stance of the New York Times, but in this case, I certainly do. Speaking of an editorial, a very interesting one appeared in Wednesday's edition of USA Today. Linda Vanderkam wrote an article entitled, "This Isn't Grandpa's Retirement." One of the important themes for Christians to consider in this particular time, in this generation, is exactly how we rethink retirement. And let's just talk about the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom for most people in America for the last, say, two or three or even five decades has been that you work a reasonable amount of time and then, say, at age 60 to 62 to 65, depending upon the setup of the retirement plan, you can retire and then you have years, perhaps even decades, of what can best be described as leisure. Well, that needs to be rethought on Christian terms even before the economy requires us to rethink it in economic terms. There is no biblical concept of retirement in terms of entering just a period of leisure when we have energy and intelligence and work and wisdom to contribute. Now, Linda Vanderkam in this article is talking about how older Americans today are continuing to work and actually enjoying it. Some do not enjoy it, of course, because they're employed in ways that that do not indeed exhilarate and excite them. But a good many people now can plan ahead for what really is a redeployment rather than retirement. A second or third career, something that will indeed bring about some income, but more importantly, will make a contribution. She writes, "A growing number of older Americans are having similar thoughts. After decades of decline, the labor force participation rate among people older than 65 rose from a low of 10.7% in 1987 to more than 17% now." That's an amazing statistic when you think about it. 17% of persons in that age bracket who are now gainfully employed. She writes, "Nearly a third of those ages 65 to 69 are working or looking for work, up from less than 20% in the 1980s, and surveys of baby boomers find that many don't intend to retire immediately either." Now, there's one sentence in her article that really caught my eye. Listen to this. "But that's not all that's going on. The notion that work is something you want to stop doing is getting a makeover as well." Something very healthy about that. And perhaps the shock of this economic dislocation and the Great Recession that started in 2008 is bringing about a healthy rethinking of retirement. This is not a slander on the idea of retirement if retirement means making a contribution rather than just leisure. The Christian worldview validates leisure, but leisure within the context of a life that is making a contribution. And let's be honest, not every contribution is defined by employment. The big issue is, for the sake of the kingdom of Christ, how are Christians at every age maximally deployed for the glory of God? USA Today also had a very interesting story on the front page. The headline is, "Ebook sales hit new heights." Now, there's one statistic in here that really caught my attention, several that are worthy of our note, but here's just one. Over the last week, that's over the last 7 days, about 3 to 5 million e-readers were activated. You're talking Christmas gifts there. But that's a massive number, 3 to 5 million. All right, how many of those people are going to read books? Well, in the period just one day after Christmas, the 24 hours after Christmas, 1 million ebooks were sold. All right, that's a sign of the future. We're no longer talking about a peripheral to publishing margin here. We're talking about a clear sign about the future. Now, one of the things I've written about is the fact that I don't read on an e-reader exactly the same kind of book that I would want to read in print. I don't read exactly the same way that I read in print. There's still something very important for important books about having them in hand, having them in print, having them behind those two very familiar bound covers, being able to have a pen to take notes, to make my marks in the margins and all the rest. But there's also something almost magical about the ability to hit a few buttons and have an ebook magically appear on an e-reader. And when I go on the road, on my Kindle alone, I can take 3,500. I don't have 3,500 ebooks, but I could, on this little machine that's smaller than the average printed book, hold 3,500 books. I do have many books on my Kindle, and also I use the Kindle app on the iPad. And once again, the iPad surged in sales over the Christmas holiday. As a matter of fact, when yesterday we talked about the tablet being the great digital device, which is likely to be the market of the future, well, you don't have to look very far to the future. You can just look to the past. The past 14 days and the sales of tablet computers, in particular the iPad. And how, for instance, the New York Times reported on Wednesday, schools, in particular colleges and universities, now see the iPad as a very important delivery device for academic materials looking to the future. That's something to watch as well. Finally, something that caught my attention in the New York Times on Wednesday's edition, Julie Bosman reports that there's a new edition of Mark Twain's works coming out, in particular his two most famous works, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Why? Well, this publisher in Alabama is coming out with an edition that removes the most offensive word, which has been so much an issue of controversy in those two works. It's a derogatory word that had been used historically of African Americans. Now, this raises a very important issue. Some of the literary purists are complaining that changing that word to something that is, well, more politically correct is a way of ruining the literature. I want to speak in general in defense of letting literature stand as it is. Mark Twain's use of that language marks his time and dates that literature in terms of the worldview of the age. I think very few things can trump that kind of literary authenticity. But honestly, I think this is one of them. Here's a test, and it's a test that came to me when I was in discussions about this issue with some folks in times past, and it's one that actually finds its way into this article. Would you be willing to read this text aloud? If the answer to that is no, then it's a sign that this kind of development, though it should be rare, is probably right. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. Follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.